Welcome to the GoTo Podcast. Each episode covers the brightest and boldest ideas from the world's leading experts in software development. Tune in for practical lessons, compelling theories, and plenty of inspiration. GoTo gathers the brightest minds in the software community to help developers tackle projects today, plan for tomorrow, and create a better future. Stay up to date with the latest in tech through GoTo's top-rated events held online and in person in cities like Amsterdam, London, Copenhagen, and Chicago, and by subscribing to the GoTo Conferences YouTube channel, where you can find thousands more high-quality dev talks. Learn more at gotopia.tech.
Hello and welcome to the GoTo Book Club, where today I'm going to talk to Anne Curry about her recently published book, Cloud Native Attitude, which she wrote with Jamie Dobson. And I'm really looking forward to digging into the details, but I want to start with introductions. Anne, can you introduce yourself?
Hi, Sarah. My name is Anne Curry. I am the author of the book that we're going to talk about today is The Cloud Native Attitude, which is an interesting subject of today's call for many reasons, which will become clear soon. But I'm also the author of O'Reilly's new book, Building Green Software, which is very, as it turns out, relevant to Cloud Native. Cloud Native is very relevant to that. And I have been in the tech industry as an IC, as a manager, as an all the things for 30 years now.
Wow. Wow. I think I'm at 25 years, which is quite hard to believe it's been quite that long. And we've known each other for quite a long time. And in fact, we spoke for the case study for this book for the Financial Times quite a long time ago. I think it was 2017 initially. And I should start by saying I love the book. I mean, I think it's such a good overview of what cloud native actually means. And I've frequently referred to it when I've wanted to explain to someone what are the components of cloud native. But I want to start by saying, what's your focus with the book? Why did you write it? Why are you doing a third edition and who should be reading it?
So actually, there's quite a lot of things to untangle in that question. So I do want to say this is a very unusual book club go-to podcast because Sarah, who's interviewing me, is also one of the stars of the book. and in many ways, you represent the reason why the book was written. Back in, I think it was 2017, me and Jamie Dobson, who was the CEO of Container Solutions at the time, we were sitting having coffee at QCon London, which is a big tech conference that runs every year in London. And this year, Sarah, you are the chair of that conference. But anyway, so this was 8 years ago, we were sitting around. And at the time, almost every talk at QCon was about microservices, cloud, containers, or orchestrators. And it was all very interesting. I was fascinated by this, really fascinated by containers and the changes that they were going to introduce. The CNCF, the Cloud Native Computing Foundation, had just been formed. At the time, we just had no idea whether or not that was complete crazy talk on the part of the Linux Foundation, because we didn't really know whether people were actually doing anything with all of these newfangled things in the wild. So, So basically, Jamie set me off to go off and investigate and actually write down what it all meant and how it all works and how it all fitted together and what obviously the plan was, and then talk to a whole load of people who seemed to be ahead on this and what they were doing, real people, real enterprises. Were they doing anything? Because obviously we were saying, well, this is lovely to hear about this at conferences, but is it real? Is it just completely, you know, maybe Google's doing it, but no normal enterprise is doing it. So we wrote the book in order to try and get our heads around what was going on. Really, and you were one of the people who was sucked in. At the FT, you were one of my prime case studies of actual users of this stuff in the field.
So I think it's interesting because I think at the time we spoke, I don't know that I would have described us as cloud native, but then I also don't know that I knew what cloud native is. And actually, that's one I want to ask you about, which is cloud native is one of those terms that people use, and I'm not sure people even mean the same thing by it. You know, I've heard that the trivial thing is, well, it's built to run on the cloud rather than just being shipped to it. But I think there's more to it than that. And I'd like to understand your definition of cloud native.
Defining cloud native was one of the reasons why we wrote the book. Because at the time, this was back when the CNCF was first formed, they defined cloud native as, oh gosh, container packaged, orchestrated microservices built for scale and cost and efficiency. And we thought, well, actually, it's not crazy, but it's quite a complicated definition. Does that mean that if you only do some of those things, then you're not cloud native? You know, you have to do all of the things and you have to be in the cloud and you have to be releasing 20 times a day and you have to be, otherwise you're not cloud native. In which case, what I found out was that pretty much nobody would have been cloud native. maybe Google was, but not nobody else. And in fact, even now, very, very few people meet that the requirements of all of those things, although it has become more and more. I mean, obviously, I think it's turned out that that was probably the direction of travel because there's so much value to doing all of those things. I came to the conclusion it was a bit of a spectrum, and it was also an attitude more than anything else. It was the desire. It was the desire to be able to move. So I would say it really comes down to be able to change your systems, to be able to take advantage of services and third party services, new stuff as it becomes available. You're very involved in team topologies and that kind of movement towards fast flow and faster rolling out of new fit. And this was your major focus when you're at the FT, which is why you were so interesting to talk to at the time, because you were all walking the walk, not just talking the talk. So that was good. But I'm more and more thinking that cloud native was for the kind of people who cared about their bottlenecks in running, what was slowing them down, what was holding them back, and were attempting to address those bottlenecks. And it's often, many years ago, I was head of IT for an enterprise, and the big bottleneck, the biggest bottleneck was always infrastructure. It was always how long it took to get stuff in our data center ready to run. And then we had to change something, it was a disaster. I mean, it was like, oh yeah, everybody wants this tiny tweak, but we've got, you know, it's totally out of our hands how long we're going to have to wait for the hardware. And not because anybody was an idiot. That was just the way that the world worked. We had unbelievably clever operations folk who were tearing their hair out constantly over this. It just took ages.
Well, it's because you went and bought a server and then you configured it. And we actually kept track of the metrics at the FT. So I know that when I first joined in 2011, it was 6 months to get our production server bought, racked up with everything on it. And that was probably the first change that the FT did, was to try and look at automated provisioning. And I remember we got to 15 minutes by 2014. So we went from 6 months to 15 minutes. And then shortly after that, at the time I was an engineer hands-on on a team, I was complaining because it was taking 15 minutes because you just you get spoiled by how quickly you can do it. And you can't do things like microservices until you can spin up, basically, I've got this idea for a service. Well, I've got to wait 6 months for a server.
Yeah, it was the gigantic bottleneck. I never really, until I'd reached the point where I could really see what was holding up the whole organization. I always used to think the software was difficult. And then I realized that I'd been living in a dream world in which, you know, software is so easy compared to hardware. It was really hard. Things like, just like the data center doesn't have a socket for you to plug in another machine. And I think that's really where cloud native comes from. It's people going, what is my first bottleneck? And it's usually infrastructure. Can I get infrastructure as a service? And then you start from there. And then you move on to your next bottleneck, which is often, well, for a lot of the people I talked to the first time I wrote the book, it was, and another problem for me, I remembered from when I was doing the same job, that hiring skilled ops folk, very hard. And so a lot of the desire for moving into the cloud was to be able to do it with fewer skilled ops folk because they were really hard to get your hands on.
Yes, but I think what you're making me think about with cloud native is it's very easy for organizations to think we want to move to the cloud and to forget what it is they're trying to achieve by doing that. And I think with cloud native, you've got an idea of, we're not just taking this application and putting it into the cloud, to run on AWS. You're actually trying to achieve some outcome that you couldn't get when you're in the data center.
Absolutely. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Indeed, it's all about identifying your bottleneck, because it might be that your bottleneck is not your infrastructure or hiring people or any of the things that the cloud will help you with. Your bottleneck could be something completely different, in which case you don't need to go cloud, you don't need to think about moving to the cloud. And not everybody who wants to move to an infrastructure service model goes to the cloud. Some people build it themselves, but it's quite expensive. So, you know, I mean, Facebook aren't in the cloud, they built it themselves, but they have.
But I think in the book, you talk about several fundamental architectural principles of cloud native. And I guess, actually, I don't think any of them include the cloud. And it's like infrastructure as code, which we've talked about, containers and orchestrators. So I guess you don't have to be in the cloud to be doing that either. What changed around? Because I think when you wrote the first edition for this, it was relatively new, all of this stuff. So yeah. What changed between the first and the third edition for this, do you think?
The massive, massive change and it was, 8 years ago? It wasn't that long ago. It's like a lifetime ago. When we wrote the first edition, it was not clear which orchestrator was going to win. Mm-hmm. I think I'm not sure that you'd even started Kubernetes at that point, because it was quite new, and it came in a little bit later than, so Mesosphere was riding high.
Yeah.
A Swarm from Docker.
Yes.
They were looking like they might be the orchestrators that would take over the world. But the only two that have survived, Kubernetes just totally taken over everything. And Nomad from HashiCorp still exists and is still a good orchestrator. It kind of like coasted all the way through. Mm-hmm. But basically everything else got kicked up the backside by Kubernetes.
Yes, we did that. We actually did build our own orchestration when we started using containers at the Financial Times, because nothing was really out there that was going to work for us. But we did quite swiftly move to Kubernetes once it was available, once people were using it in production.
Yeah, I mean, I'm casting my mind back, but I think that the book it covers 8 years. The third edition, which just came out, covers 8 years. So it covers all the principles of cloud native are pretty much the same, because they are just principles, and they have totally stood the test of time and have turned out to be pretty much exactly as we predicted 8 years ago. Because obviously Sarah was one of the early reviewers of all copies of the book. But the case studies, we revisited everybody. So everybody who's now in the case study has been revisited throughout, basically. And I think there are three that there was the FT was not Kubernetes in the first version, but is massively now.
Well, you say that it is, but it's also the point I left. There were many other ways of deploying stuff, and it was always a mix of different things. Yeah.
Okay. Well, that is interesting. Yes. So Starling Bank were not Kubernetes in 2017, but I believe that they are now. They were homegrown. They built their own orchestrator to start with, as many people did back then, because you didn't necessarily need to start with Kubernetes. So it's quite advanced. In some ways, it was easier obviously, you don't want to have to build your own orchestrator, but it's not rocket science to build an orchestrator, bizarrely enough, to do very simple things like automatic restarts. It's not.
Yeah.
Ridiculously complicated. So in some ways, you got everybody into the mindset of what an orchestrator did by just going, oh, well, I've just run a batch job to do this. The other key case study that really, really I've stalked them throughout their entire existence is Skyscan. And they were ECS back in 2017, and they are now very Kubernetes. So the world has really changed in a way that we did not predict at the time. Everybody was kind of holding off because we weren't sure who was going to win.
Yes. Well, it's changed, but also you are right. All of those foundations are still there and are still important and still give you value whether you do all of it or some of it.
Oh, no, I was just going to say there's a whole chapter in the book on orchestrators, which despite the fact that actually every orchestrator has changed completely, all the ones that were big at the time are dead, all the ones that were hardly in existence at the time are now taken over the world. The chapter has barely changed because it was all about the principle of orchestrators. Yeah. The principles remain identical.
Well, I think that's what's great about the book. It is about the principles. It is about what are these things and why do they matter? So you've got quite a lot in a chapter in the book about CICD, about continuous delivery, and which is something that wasn't in that original CNCF definition, but actually is pretty fundamental if you're going to really be cloud native and benefit from it.
Yeah, I came to the conclusion that it was actually the most important thing being cloud native. If you didn't implement CICD, everybody did. It was the only thing that was utterly common between every single person I talked to, is that they were really keen on CICD and fast, frequent deploys to production. But having said that, I had a bit of an epiphany on that the other day. I was giving a talk about the book, and in the front row was Greg Hawkins, who is another person I interviewed. He was the CTO of Starling Bank at the time. And I talked his ear off for all versions of the book. I was talking and I was looking at him. I was thinking, he would probably pick me up on this, because I was saying, I think that CICD and this fast flow thing was the main thing that cloud native was all about. And as I was talking, I was suddenly struck by this epiphany, which I then said out loud, which is never a good thing to do while you're like, just in case it's stupid. Because it could easily be stupid, which was what I was considering to be kind of, there's a causation correlation thing here, that all the people that I spoke to I spoke to all the companies in basically the UK, because they were the ones I had the easiest access to, who were the absolute acme of cloud native, as far as I could see. They were the most modern systems. And what they had in common was that they did fast, small releases using CICD. Yeah. And so I thought, right, it's fast, small releases that are the fundamental concept of CICD. But then actually, as I was speaking, I thought, it could just be that I'm looking, it could be, let's take the reverse of that. I was looking at the companies that were successful in doing something really difficult. And actually, what could be that you're only successful in doing something really difficult in tech if you're doing CICD and you're doing small incremental releases, because otherwise you don't have that feedback loop. You can't do difficult stuff. I mean, and that was what you were attempting to get at the FT out of cloud native more than anything else.
Yeah, I mean, we went from releasing the website 12 times a year to doing 20,000 releases a year across the whole estate. It just is completely different. It's one of the reasons that that fast flow that comes out of both team topologies and Accelerate. I think if you move to the cloud and you still can't release things quickly, then you're probably having additional complexity without getting the benefit potentially.
Absolutely.
And actually, I think you mentioned in this edition of the book that there's been a bit of a swing away from microservice architectures, which is interesting to me because obviously I wrote a book about microservices. But what's interesting is I think that whatever people are replacing it with, it's still things that enable them to do small releases quickly, whether it's a modular monolith, whether people are using serverless more.
When Starling first went live, they were more like a kind of macro service model. It wasn't microservices. They were quite big, chunky things, although they've moved more in the direction of microservices because they want to do more frequent releases. Mm-hmm. And the same thing, Skyscanner had their monolith in the mix for a very long time indeed. Yeah. And because you don't always need to go, you don't have to be Monzo. You don't have to have a million microservices because it's quite complicated. Mm. You know, it's, it's complicated if you want to run microservices and have speed, so you're doing things that are synchronous, and that's very hard. Mm-hmm. It's so, yeah, there's, I think you need to start with what is your need.
Yes.
And microservices can be amazing if you want to use third-party services as well. But is there a third-party service that you want to use? If there isn't, then it might not be worth investing in that complexity.
Yeah. So it's called the cloud native attitude. Mm. What is the attitude that works for that? So I guess what did you see in the people in the case studies, but also, if someone's considering that they want to sort of move towards this, what do they need to have in place?
I would say the attitude was, it was a desire to be able to change things and take advantage of third-party services and just change and move and change. And in fact, it was that reason that I really twisted Jamie's arm to re-release the third edition, because I'd written Building Green Software for O'Reilly with my two lovely co-authors, Sarah and Sara, for that. All the Sarahs. What became very clear was that what was holding people back more than anything else in being green, it wasn't the lack of desire to be green. It was the lack of the ability to move at all. And that really made me think, you know, that was what the cloud native attitude was about. The attitude was the desire to move and the ability to move. And it's hard to go cloud native. You have to get everybody involved. It has to be buy-in from the bottom of the organization to the top. You have to be incredibly persistent. It's going to take years and years. And so you have to really want it. You have to have the attitude that you're willing to put that investment in order to become a really agile, with a small a, agile, reactive organization, the ability to change. And that's a desire to change. The desire, obviously, it's not the desire to change. The desire to have the ability to change is the cloud native attitude for me.
Yes, and I think that I definitely saw that the FT, one of the reasons we were successful was because actually from the top we had a culture that we're going to try. We want to do this. We had a very open culture and. Mm. That sense of basically being prepared to invest in improving things, I think is really important. You mentioned sustainability, and actually that's a whole like new, there's much more discussion of it in this version of it. So what's the sustainability challenge, and how does cloud native help with that?
The sustainability challenge is fundamentally that it's, there are some things you can do to be sustainable that are really easy. Anyone can do them, and you don't have to be cloud native to do them. You don't have to be in a cloud or anything like that. Mm-hmm. It's just, you know, turning things off that are waste, that don't need to be on, right sizing, all that kind of stuff. And the irony is, doing those simple steps probably save you about the biggest chunk of carbon you will ever save. It'll probably it can quite easily, and usually we see, it's cutting people's carbon bills between 30% and 50%. And at that stage, that's also their hosting bill. So at the early stage, your hosting bill and your carbon bill are pretty much, you know, they're very directly correlated. Mm-hmm. To take it further than that, then you need to start automating that stuff. You need to do automated right sizing, aka auto scaling. And it's very hard to do that stuff outside of the cloud. There are services that exist to help you do that. A lot of the services that exist to help you do that are in the cloud. To get to the next stage, you really have to be, or you have to be able to turn off machines. You have to be able to turn off machines automatically. You have to be able to respond to changes in demand and fluctuating. You have to be a lot cleverer. You have to have real organizational smarts to get to the next stage. And then that doing that can halve your carbon bill again. So you get your, by, you know, doing this initial pass and then getting really good at operations, you should be able to cut your carbon bill by broadly 75%. But you do need to use the techniques of cloud native to get to that next stage. Level three of the maturity matrix, we call it. I would also call that effectively being cloud native. To get further than that is interesting. To get further, to get beyond really good ops, which is everybody's best interest, because it's much more resilient, saves you money, and it's much more secure. So, but to get beyond that requires you to do things like write code-efficient code. And you do not, most enterprises do not want to and should not ever do that, because it's really, really expensive. You want to buy it off the shelf so that the investment, this used to be my area back in the, when I was really young, 30 years ago, it was writing really efficient code in C. And it's really difficult and it's really expensive. If someone writes it, you want lots of people to use it. You don't just want them to use it. It's no point that it's a crazy investment for an enterprise to make. It's a perfectly good investment for a vendor to make. Mm-hmm. So you want to buy it off the shelf. So you want the ability to buy things like that off the shelf. And that's really, again, where it comes down, where the cloud-native attitude comes in. You need to have the ability to take advantage of what I would call what we call green platforms, platforms that are efficient, that will just keep getting, that will just take you to carbon zero under your feet without you having to do anything. But you have to adopt them. So all we need to do is get people the ability to move to such a platform. Not write it, just the ability to move to it.
So really, something really interesting there to me is that lots of the stuff that's actually, you're saying the first thing that gives you a huge reward is a manual process. I think there's a thing where things that aren't exciting but can make a big difference. And actually that pragmatism of it doesn't have to be perfect, but we can do something that gets us closer to where we want to go, I think is something that made us very successful at the Financial Times. We didn't want to build the perfect solution. We were okay with something that was much more simple, but gave us a lot of what we wanted. And I suspect it's more exciting to think about learning how to write very efficient code than it is to think about the other side of it, just actually looking at what have you got left running that you haven't turned off.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. It's not very glamorous, is it? There's a company in London called Ravelin who run these regular, what they call thriftathons. So rather than a hackathon, you know, an exciting hackathon, everybody gets to write some code, they do a thriftathon regularly, where someone wins by turning off the most stuff and saving the most money. And I think that's fantastic.
That is fantastic. We used to have gardening days in the platform engineering teams at the Financial Times, where the idea was we're going to do the weeding. We're basically going to go around and just clean things up and make everything look super tidy. And I love it because it is gardening. It is like if you do this periodically, your garden will continue to look nice and you'll get benefit from it. I think that's really good. I think it's really interesting to say, like, move to the cloud and you can take advantage of a lot of this sustainability stuff, because my experience is very often people move to the cloud and then 6 months in, the finance people are saying, why is it costing us more to run things now than it did when we had our own data center? I mean, what do you think about that?
Well, yes, the cloud is not guaranteed to be green. In fact, unfortunately, most people who move into the cloud become less green, not more green. And I think one of the problems is that moving into the cloud has such a wide range of meaning as to be essentially meaningless. If you just lift and shift into the cloud, but you don't use any of the services, then you're just running an incredibly expensive on-prem data center where it's really easy for you to just keep over-provisioning and buy more. I mean, the good thing about the old days when it took ages to buy a machine was that you didn't over-provision too much because you had so, you know, you just couldn't get your hands on the stuff. Yeah. Whereas it's now so easy that things get over-provisioned. One of the stories I tell all the time from the Cloud Native Attitude is the story that you told me about the FT, about how where the FT, when you first moved into the cloud, your bills went through the roof. And then you decided that what you were going to do is give teams access to information about what their hosting bill was. And once they could see it, they just reduced it. All they needed was information.
Yeah.
And if they could just go, oh, I could just have another one. And as far as they're concerned, it doesn't cost them anything. They'll keep pressing that button.
Yeah. Yeah. And they don't necessarily pay any attention to it. They spun this thing up 3 weeks ago and they've forgotten about it. There were teams at the FT that built Slackbots that would say, hey, there's this server that you spun up. Are you still using it? And actually that you could see, and people liked being able to see what was happening to their bill. And I think that visualization is quite important. What do you think the next changes in cloud native are going to be? Is there something you can see coming up that's going to be affecting how people use all of these technologies?
Well, I mean, obviously, you're dangling there for something that I didn't mention in the book at all, although we did have a chapter on it in Building Green Software, which is AI. I just can't get over how good AI is, how good LLMs are. I think it's too soon to say, but I think so. I was talking to an old colleague who's who I very, very much trust their opinion at DevOps London, at a DevOps workshop last week. And he was saying that he started to make significant use of Claude, actually, and say it's just so enormously useful that he's using it all the time, every day, and it just massively cuts the amount of work he has to do. And, you know, he has to check over the stuff, but that's fine. It still cuts what he's doing massively. So, yeah, AI-enabled infrastructure as code, it's got to be coming, hasn't it?
Yeah. But I think the same, it's interesting because I think the principles will still be there. It'll still be the same underlying things that you're benefiting from and the reasons you're doing it. It's just that something is applying some of the stuff for you.
The chatbots are very good at explaining the principles. I asked ChatGPT about, you know, green software and kind of that kind of stuff. And you go, oh, my goodness, that's an amazing description. I could have written it myself. But especially as you kind of think, I did write an awful lot of the stuff around this.
It could be your words.
But I don't really care that much. I mean, I've written a lot of books, both fiction and non-fiction books. And one thing I can say is that as an author, you make no money. So look, the loss of your IP is not as bad as you might think. You know, there is only one J.K. Rowling. Everybody else is just doing it for them to get the message out. I mean, as a fellow O'Reilly author, Sarah, I like you, work in one day, possibly affords to share a cup of tea between the two of ourselves on our royalty payments. We do it for the message. And I don't mind someone, even if that someone is ChatGPT, reading my books in like that and then sharing the message. I have no problem with that.
I think that's true. But I also think you do it for the message and you do it for your own understanding. And that is the reason why I think there's still a reason to write. You know, the fact that it takes forever to get your thoughts in order and then you come back to it a week later and you completely change it. It's yeah, I think that's going to be, there's always value in that.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I somebody has to write the books. Somebody does have to write the books because that does involve all the thinking. And it is the most expensive way of thinking that you will ever do. But it is a very good way of thinking.
This is slightly off topic of your book, but I think spending the time to really think through something and write it up, whether it's for an internal presentation or a talk or anything like that, leaves you with a really thorough grounding in that.
Yeah.
And I think, which I think really helps. So I have a final question about the book, which is if someone reads this and thinks, I've got a challenge that this could help with, what would be the first steps you'd recommend for them to get started on it?
I would thoroughly examine your challenge. Make sure that it really is a challenge. Make sure that everybody in your organization agrees that it is a challenge, that it is worth significantly investing in solving. The key thing is it the bottleneck? Is it what you should be solving? Because you've got to, and it has to be convincing. You have to convince everybody because it's so difficult. It's the writing a book of IT organizations. It's so hard. You will learn a load. It'll be amazingly useful, but it's so hard. You have to make sure that everybody agrees that that is the problem that you should be focused on. Mm-hmm. And if you can get everybody to agree to that, then if they don't agree, then it's worth listening to what they think really is the problem and make sure that you aren't thinking, right, we'll do this amazing project that's going to take up everybody's mind cycles for years and years, whilst there's a bigger problem and a bigger choke point or bottleneck that it won't be resolved by that project. That is good in all senses. You can work out whether it really is the thing that you need to be doing next. But if you talk to everybody and you become convinced and you convince everybody else that it is the thing that everybody needs to work on, it'll be a lot easier for you because then everybody will be on the same page and pulling together. It will be aligned.
I mean, I think that's amazing, but that means people are having a single coherent engineering strategy, which is a really like surprisingly challenging thing, I think, to come up with. But I agree that I think knowing that, we at one point at the FT had an objective for the year, which, well, it was for several years, actually. It was cloud only 2020, and which was a great objective because you knew exactly what it was and when it had to be done by and how you'd be measured for it. And it worked because everyone was completely aligned in it. Everybody knew what they had to do to make that happen. So yeah, I think having that sense that everyone is up with it. And I think, so it's really interesting to me, a lot of times you have a couple of teams within an organization that want to bring in infrastructure as code, they want to bring in automation, they maybe start some work. I think you hit a natural limit if you haven't convinced everybody else that there's a reason to do things like that.
Yeah, I think that is true. Alignment is step one, isn't it? Getting everybody on the same page and in agreement. And then step two is CI/CD.
Oh, God, yes. If you did that and nothing else, you'll improve things so much. The difference that I found between writing code and it maybe going live in 4 weeks, 6 weeks, and writing code and I could push it live that day was just amazing. Both in terms of the benefits to the organization, but also just what it's like to be a developer. Just so yeah. much more rewarding.
Yeah, it's yes. So those that neither of those things are classically what you'd describe as cloud native.
No.
But they are still the most important. You have to build your platforms. Build your platform is something an old colleague of mine used to say all the time, and he was quite right. And then after that, you can start thinking about whether you want to be in the cloud, because and you say there are pros and cons. If you're a startup these days, I think you'd be absolutely mad to not be in the cloud. But I can also see why it is a really difficult thing to do, especially if I feel lift and shift projects are very, very problematic indeed. I mean, I can see why people do it. It's totally, theoretically, it's a good move. Theoretically, good is a good move. But I think psychologically, it's a very risky move, because to make the cloud work, you're going to have to do iterative small, you're going to have to move into a mindset of yeah. iterative small steps. And putting a gigantic single monolithic project right at the start of that doesn't get you in the right mindset, does it?
It doesn't. And even if you are moving things that are relatively small, I think that having that lift and shift mentality of we're just going to do what we do, but we'll do it on someone else's servers. We definitely had to learn that it's a lot quicker to use the components that you can buy from the cloud providers than it is to build and operate your own database cluster. But we had to learn it by doing it.
Yeah.
And I think if you lift and shift, and normally what happens is you decide you're going to do it. There's some kind of deadline that means you have to do it. And then you're all exhausted and you've got everything running in the cloud and it's more expensive than it was in the data center and you haven't got any benefits from it. And then the will to do the next step can just disappear. Yeah.
It is. I mean, will is what delivers projects more than anything yes. else. And if you burn it all out and you're all disappointed and everybody's going, but you said when we're in the cloud, everything would be great. And it's like, well, we're in the cloud, but we're only halfway to where we need to be. That's a really hard sell. You know,
it is. And I think this is where the attitude comes into it. You really, you need to be moving to cloud native with a vision of what you're trying to, as your book says, with a vision of what you're trying to achieve and with an attitude that's going to make it work for you, definitely. Mm. And with that, I think we are pretty much out of time. It's been a great discussion. Thank you so much. And thanks for speaking to me about your book. And I really recommend it to people. It's a great and small, I always like to recommend short books that can be read quickly. Because basically you get a lot out of investing the time to read it. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the GoTo Podcast. Head over to gotopia.tech to discover lots more content from the brightest minds in software development.